Academicians, ladies and gentlemen, greetings from Chicago. It is indeed a special honor and privilege for me to be with you to talk about the issues that you have been debating, discussing at a national seminar on caste census. It is an important topic. It has come up in the main conversation and political discourse at a national level because this really connects with inequality, inclusion, and ultimately sustainability. The fact that you are coming together to discuss the need for census at this important time does deserve a lot of attention. I'm told that the last census was really in 1931 or so. I'm also surprised to learn that there are 2,850 some odd categories of OBC. I'm also a part of OBC. I will talk about my background a little bit later on, especially for the young people who may not know a little bit about me and my work in India, because most of my work in India was done about 40 years ago. In Rajiv Gandhi era. But let me begin with the basic idea of OBC. I personally do not like this idea that we are called other backward class. I do not want to be identified as a backward class. Who told me that I'm backward? Who are you to tell me I'm backward? I'm as forward as anybody else can find. So I'm not willing to accept this idea of other backward class. We are a working class people. We are proud of the fact that we are sons and daughters of carpenters and blacksmiths and plumbers and electricians or whatever. The notion of other backward class itself is demeaning. If you look at the history, all wars have come out of the idea of exclusion. During British Raj, we were excluded and we were fighting for inclusion, freedom, liberty, equality, rights, justice. And as OBC, in the present terminology, people are also fighting for the same reasons. Because they are excluded, they are discriminated. They want justice, they want equality, freedom. You look at what is going on in Israel and Gaza. It is also a challenge of equality. In India, we have a caste system. In America, we have Black Lives Matter. Not very different. Martin Luther King fought for the rights of the black. Mandela fought apartheid. And Gandhiji fought for freedom of the people of India. But even within free India, the caste system has been daunting us for centuries. It is the way we divide people in a very diverse society, in a society which really thrives on diversity. We begin to divide people based on caste, whether it is OBC, Dalits, Muslims, Christians, based on religion, race, color, language, you name it. So it is very important first to get data. And what you are fighting for is really all about gathering data. How many people are from this category? Who are these people? Where are they placed? What are their rights and privileges and benefits they get? And how well they are represented in a democracy? How many vice chancellors are from OBC? How many professors? How many scientists? How many engineers? How many doctors? How many IAS officers, politicians? The list can go on and on and on. The idea is to really represent every part of the diverse society, to represent their presence and also their numbers to some extent. It is a very long journey. We are at a point in the history of India where we are just about to take off in a very big way after 75 years of hard work. Our founding fathers rightfully understood the importance of education, infrastructure, and they rightfully focused on democracy, human rights, freedom, justice, equality. Not that we have delivered everything, but we have been able to create a mold where a diverse society like India could keep democracy intact. I'll give you an example. When Rajiv Gandhi was Prime Minister, I used to go to Soviet Union quite often in Gorbachev's time. In one of my meetings, a minister in Gorbachev's government told me that, "Mr. Pitroda, we get very impressed with India. And the only reason we admire India, perhaps, is that India has been able to hold herself together with such a diverse population without guns." And I really didn't understand the emphasis he was making. When Soviet Union fell apart, I remember his words that the day we turn our guns around, our country will fall apart. And that's exactly what happened in Soviet Union. I hope you understand the meaning of this, that India has been able to hold together as a democracy in spite of the diversity we have. Diversity of race, religion, caste, color, language, and all that. And that has been the accomplishment of India in the last 75 years. This democracy is being threatened today in many different ways. This democracy is threatened because our institutions are being captured. Media is being manipulated and controlled. Civil society is not really allowed to be functioned properly. And rational, logical thinking is not really encouraged. In a country of 1.5 billion people, when you discourage teaching of theory of evolution and periodic table, you have something fundamentally wrong going on in the society. It is in this light we got to see the challenges of OBC. So to me, inclusion is a global challenge. And it comes in different forms in different places. As I said earlier, in America, it is about Black Lives Matter. In India, it is about OBC and caste and Dalits and tribals and minorities. And in Europe, nowadays, it is more about migration. Let me tell you about my own personal journey to give you an idea of what OBC meant to me. I was born in British Raj in 1942. I'm 82 years old. I was born in a small little tribal village in Orissa. Naturally, no electricity, no water, running water, no nothing, no hospital, no pharmacy, no doctor. We were eight in the family, five sisters and three brothers. And my father had fourth grade education. He worked for about 20 rupees a month salary in those days. But when India became independent, he felt empowered. He felt empowered to a point he realized that now we are no longer a subject, but we are citizens. We are free to do whatever we want to do. In our little house, we had pictures, big pictures on the wall of Gandhiji, Nehru, Sardar Patel, Maulana Azad, and Subhash Chandra Bose. These were the heroes of those days, who many, like my father, felt people they could look up to. So my father decided that now he's going to make sure that his children can get education. He realized that education is empowering. Education is defining yourself, redefining yourself. And he sent us to a boarding school when I was 9 years old and my older brother was 12 years old. We went to a Gandhian boarding school in Gujarat, because my father came from Gujarat, settled in Orissa. And in that school, we learned our basic lessons about Gandhian way of thinking. I went to boarding school in 1950. There we learned the idea of truth, trust, love, democracy, diversity, inclusion, justice. I studied there for 5 years and then went to Baroda to an engineering school because I was son of a carpenter and I wanted to study engineering, how to make things, how to build things, because that was natural to me. That was in my DNA. I finished 2 years of school in a technical school with carpentry, lathe work, machine tools, drawing, engineering, and then got interested in physics. So I studied BSc Physics. I was the first one in my family to get degree, studied master's in physics, in electronics, and one fine day read in the newspaper that President Kennedy has decided to take man onto the moon. And it sounded romantic. So I decided to come to America. I had no money. So I earned money through teaching students physics and math for about 3-4 years. Made a fair amount of money and took a boat from Mumbai to Karachi, Karachi to Aden, Aden to Egypt, Egypt to Genoa via Naples to see Pompeii, took a train from Genoa to London, took a plane from London to New York, and took a bus from New York to Chicago. This was 60 years ago. I lived in Chicago for 60 years. I never thought that I'm son of a carpenter, never worried about the fact that I was OBC, but I knew that I had to work harder because I didn't have the privilege that some of my Brahmin friends had, because their parents were judges, lawyers, doctors. And my parents had fourth grade education. But my advantage was that my parents trusted us, loved us. My father had no idea of what I studied. Finally, I remember when he came to America in 1970s, he asked me one day, he said, "What did you really study?" And I said, "Dad, I studied physics." And his next question was, "What is physics?" That was the power of his love. He trusted us. He believed that education is very important. And he never asked us, "What are you studying? What is your grade? Did you pass? Did you fail?" No. And we also realize the importance of trust that he had put into us. I always had first grade distinction. Not that I was a great student, but I had this fear that I couldn't disappoint my parents. I had to deliver. I also realized that I had to be better than others because they had an advantage and I had a little disadvantage. After coming here, I wanted to get a PhD in physics. I changed it to electrical engineering, got a master's in electrical engineering for a year, called my girlfriend from India, got married here in Chicago 58 years ago, started family, built businesses here, called one by one all my brothers and sisters here. I have nobody in India now. My entire family is here, all brothers and sisters, their children, grandchildren. We are about 100 people here in Chicago, Sacramento, Washington, Atlanta, California. I have two wonderful kids, almost 50 and 47. I have a son who went to MIT, went to Harvard. I have a daughter who went to Michigan, makes movies in Hollywood. And we really took advantage of the fact that we were OBC, that we had to work hard. Never ask anybody for any favors, never. Never felt that we are underprivileged. And I think that's the message that I have for a lot of young people. Don't let anybody tell you that you are less capable. Don't let anybody even give you a thought that you can't do this. And that's why I think it's important for me to tell you my story. You have to build a good self. I tell all young students that the most important thing in your life is to build a good self that nobody teaches you how to do. A self that is respectful, dignified, self that is rooted in discipline, creativity, analysis, moral, ethics. These things are very difficult. And only you can do it. No business schools will teach you these things. It will only come from within. And as OBC students, you have a bigger challenge. But if you don't focus on that and wait for government to do this, government to do that, it won't happen. Of course, we should insist that government do their job. I'm not saying we shouldn't insist. Of course, we should insist that there is be justice, that our people get certain benefits. But you can't ride on other people giving you something. You have to ride on your delivering to the society. And you have to work harder compared to others. Then I built a business here in 1974, sold a company, became vice president of Rockwell International, where we used to make space shuttle. And I came to India and could not make a phone call to my wife in 1979. Little bit of arrogance and a lot of ignorance said, I'm going to fix this. So I decided to work on telephones in India as my mission. I met Mrs. Indira Gandhi, asked for an hour with her. She gave me an hour. I gave a presentation where the entire cabinet was there. Pranab Mukherjee, Venkat Raman, they were all there. Arjun Singh, Gundu Rao, you know, and that's when I met Rajiv Gandhi for the first time. He was about 2 years younger than I am. And we clicked. And when Mrs. Gandhi died and Rajiv Gandhi became prime minister, I decided to come back to India to build India's IT and telecom industry. I worked with Rajiv Gandhi as the advisor to the prime minister. I became first chairman of the telecom commission, and I spent a decade with him on technology missions related to water, immunization, cooking oil, education, milk production, and telecom. I worked with Kurien on white revolution. And then when Rajiv Gandhi died, I decided to come back to US. By then I had given up my US nationality. I'd become Indian citizen. I put my house in order because I never got or took any salary in India. So I had to earn some more money here. Then when Manmohan Singh became prime minister, I came back again to work on knowledge commission, innovation, digital India. In between, I set up a bank in London, spent 7 years in London, working for the United Nations to run a bank for them called Worldtel to privatize telecom in Africa. Traveled to about 80, 90 countries, had a very interesting activity on telecom to privatize telecom in the rest of the world, especially Africa, Latin America, and Asia. When that got done, I joined Manmohan Singh. When BJP government came, I again came back home to Chicago. This is my home. And I run things out of here most of the time. But I'm fully connected with India. I'm very concerned about what is going on in India. And when I get a chance to talk to young people like you all, I feel that India lives in all of our young. We have a very young population, but our young are sometimes misguided. I want our young to feel that you can change the destiny of a country. But you cannot change by focusing on religion, by focusing on past. You got to look at future. You got to look at technology. You got to look at science. Without science, there is no future. And your future lies in creating jobs, opportunities, prosperity. And that can only come if you are given equal opportunity. And that can only come if you are included in the system. included in the conversation, you have to be at the table. If you are not at the table, you will miss out. And that's why it is important for OBC census data. If you're going to use AI to build future, you need better data. And for better data, you need good classification. But you don't need data just to ask for favors. You need data to build on better future for everybody. I'm a great believer in Gandhian values and Gandhian thought. I believe in bottom-up development as opposed to top-down development. I believe in decentralization. I've just written a book about 2-3 years ago on redesigning the world. If you get a chance, have a look at it. Because the world was last designed just about the time I was born in 1942. That design gave birth to UN, World Bank, IMF, ultimately WTO, WHO. That design is obsolete. That design was created by a handful of people from 4 or 5 countries, because then India was a colony. China didn't matter. Africa, nobody cared. But in 75 years, these countries have come alive. And the old design doesn't work. We are also at the same point in India. India is also at crossroads. The old designs in India don't work as well as it should. On one hand, we have economic prosperity. On the other hand, there are no jobs. On one hand, we have a lot of education, but the quality of education is pretty bad. And all of these things require new thinking. And that new thinking can only come from bottom up and not top down. And that's where OBC and people connected with that become very important. Today, there is a crisis of vocational education. We can't get enough welders, carpenters, blacksmiths, plumbers, well-trained, well-equipped. But that's out of fashion because everybody wants to be a lawyer and engineer and scientist and doctors. And these are the challenges that we need to discuss at length. I'm glad that you have started this conversation on OBC. I want you to keep in mind that education is the key. Education that empowers you, education that redefines you. For example, the day I became a computer scientist, people forgot that I'm a son of a carpenter. It's gone, it's wiped out. Nobody remembers I'm son of a carpenter. People remember that I'm a telecom man. That's how you redefine yourself. And only you can do that. Nobody else can do it for you. And that's where you need to have inner strength as a young student to redefine yourself. I want to help you and support you in all your effort on this OBC initiative. And I want to once again thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'll be happy to interact, answer questions if you have. But my message is very simple and clear. If I can do it, you can do it better. Because I did it 60 years ago. You can do it now. You have better tools, better opportunities, better understanding, better exposure. Hyperconnectivity gives you opportunities that you never had. For the first time in the human history, we are all connected. All 8 billion people are essentially connected. What does this connectivity really mean? And this connectivity is very different because it is about content. It is about curation. It is about communication. And hyperconnectivity is really basically democratizing knowledge, decentralizing decision making, and demonetizing services. And these are big, big ideas. And this is going to change everything. Hyperconnectivity is designing driverless cars. Hyperconnectivity is designing all kinds of new systems. Look at what is going on with AI revolution. All the old jobs that we understand today won't exist. Most of the white-collar jobs are going to be automated. In the first set of revolution, robotics and automation eliminated blue-collar jobs. Now white-collar jobs are going to be eliminated. So what are the jobs of the future? Are we really educating our students to prepare for the jobs of tomorrow or jobs of yesterday? These are the challenges that people need to ask, explore. I believe you have a great future because today, hyperconnectivity brings whole new possibilities. You can take advantage of it if you focus on education. With this, I don't take too much of your time. And once again, I want to thank you and open up for a question answer if you have. Thank you.